Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
December 8, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar, and this is the show you were looking for. How do I know this? Because you're hearing me babble right now. Anyway, it is Thursday, and I've got my two regular excellent people for Thursday here on the O'Shelly Effect, so I'm very happy. In the first hour, Mike Swanson returns from WallStreetWindow.com. Be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. It's not just about Wall Street. And, of course, he's an author of two books I highly recommend. He's an author of a bunch of books, actually, but two of them I highly recommend, and a couple of other ones that I point you to in the show notes, usually, with Mike, but The War State and also Why the Vietnam War, which is the first in a series of three on that conflict. Only one of them is out. But anyway, more to come in the future. In the second hour, author Larry Hancock will be with me, and we're going to discuss that press conference from Tuesday regarding the Mary Farrell Foundation, who actually sponsored it, and what is going on with the JFK Records Collection Act, the deadline coming up on December 15th. But all of that will be in the second hour. We tried to get Bill Simpich, who is the lead attorney, to come on tonight, and Bill must be extremely busy because no response. I'm going to have to dig out his cell phone and just get him on here in the next week or so to get him to explain all the legalese about it. But in the meantime, we'll talk to Larry Hancock about it in the second hour. But like I said, Mike Swanson is with us in the first. Glad to have you back, Mike. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Doing okay. Of course, we went to air late. We were actually, and I, full disclosure, we were talking about poker before before we went live. And I didn't have Jack Blood show today, so that's not why I'm late. Of course, if you're hearing the podcast, you don't care. It doesn't matter. But if you're listening on the live stream, we went to air late because I was actually talking to Mike about poker. He recently played in a tournament. And he was telling me how he does, and I was telling him the stupid mistakes I make when I play poker online virtually. So, yeah, anyway, it is what it is. I don't play for real money, by the way. I play, you know, in the stupid things where you buy, you know, $1 million worth of chips for, you know, $5, or you get them for free if you accomplish certain things, that kind of thing. That's what I play online. I don't have money to play. But anyway, as a motorcycle goes by, Mike, let's get into a couple of things. Now, I know that you put out some, and of course, sign up for the emails over at WallStreetWindow.com. You guys, the listeners, not you, Mike. You don't need to because you make them. But if you're listening and you're not already signed up, go over there. Sign up. Interesting stuff coming out. And some of that stuff recently has had to revolve around, oh, I don't know, the guy who might not be the richest person on the planet anymore, but is certainly a figure of interest, if you will. He has Twitter now. He has the keys. He's dropping documents. He's talking about, hey, look, you know, they might have suppressed the Hunter Biden story or made a decision to suppress it on Twitter. Dun, dun, dun. Elon Musk. All right. I haven't really talked to anybody else about this, so fair enough. And maybe I should get Artisan Loaf on my show or on Aaron's show soon to talk to you guys about this, because that guy who runs that Twitter handle and you know, makes his living his way usually has a lot to say about Elon Musk and follows all that stuff closely, but seems like none of us in the world have been able to avoid Elon Musk in the past, I don't know, few years. Anyway, Mike, what the hell? I mean, seriously, the guy who got called on the carpet for market manipulation, right, because he was doing stuff on Twitter and on social media in general, jacking up interest in his own company. There's controversy over Tesla. There's obviously, and of course, on the other side of the pond, they would say controversy. But the controversy over there, over Twitter, who is he going to let back on? He let Trump back on. He's quoting Bible verses. He's retweeting, what was it? He was retweeting white supremacists earlier this week. Or am I mixing up my Trump story with my Musk story? I don't know.
It's all the same.
Okay. I just wanted to see if you had the same attitude. What do you think of all this, given that Musk is a significant player in the financial markets, but he's also just sort of a media figure, a modern day digital folklore figure. Not Robin Hood for sure. And oh, let's not get started on Robin Hood. Is that still a thing, by the way? Is Robin Hood still out there?
It's kind of dying.
Okay.
I mean, the statistics are that there's less trading activity on Robin Hood now than it was before the March 2020 lockdowns. So it's faded out. It's fading away.
Well, I think that, and also people went broke.
That's both in the same, you know. They got stuck in bad stocks, stupid trades, and hype, and got destroyed. You know, I mean, it's been a while since we spoke. I mean, I don't want to get into this black hole, but, you know, the FTX scandal has destroyed millions of people around the world. And on one hand, we'll talk about Twitter, but I wonder, all these things are sort of related. Mm. The metaverse we spoke about before, and that's not turned out to be what it was promised it would be a year ago. There were stories, I think we spoke about them, just a couple months ago. Investigative reporters did stories that showed that the developers of the metaverse, the people creating the goggles in the virtual world, working for Mark Zuckerberg, that they don't like it, that it gives them headaches when they use the goggles.
Yeah.
And it's quotes saying that this is just something that Mark wants to do, so we got to do it. It's not working. And now the Twitter thing is, you know, blowing up, and we're also seeing, at first he's getting, you know, one of the stories about the Twitter and Musk was him firing all these people. Well, right. They're firing people at Amazon. They're firing people at a metaverse now, they call it. I still call it Facebook.
Right.
And all kinds of these internet companies. And on one hand, there's two things going on, I think, with Twitter. One, he's creating a real cult following for himself, or amplifying it or growing it. Elon Musk, that is. For some people, they believe he is, in some ways, I wonder if he's replacing Trump and Q as, you know, new things for people the people that were following Trump and Q are now following Musk. I wonder if that's the case, because every time I load it up, the first thing I see now since he's bought it is somebody worshiping him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, completely. For example, I'm loading it up right this second, and the first tweet I see is saying, wow, check this out. Twitter became a venue for the national security state, as incredible as it seems.
Mm-hmm.
The COVID response was conducted as a military operation, and the centers were treated as treason. And this person makes that comment, and he's retweeting this woman, Barry Weiss, who is doing tweets within the past 45 minutes where she's releasing what she's calling Twitter Files Part 2,
right.
Twitter's secret blacklist. So she's getting direct information from Elon to help him promote himself. And so when I load up Twitter, the first thing I see is someone, you know, linking that information and praising Elon too.
Well, and the thing about Barry Weiss is that she was a fairly prominent journalist before this anyway, and he's handed this stuff over apparently to a couple of those types to try and, you know, shake things loose and say, look at how transparent I'm being. That's interesting. I'll tell you, I don't notice this in my feed though. You know what, and I think everybody, as per usual, gets their own personalized experience from the algorithms, right? Here's what I discovered, and I don't know if this is a thing or if this is new, but see, I surf Twitter in order to find information that is a bit rarefied, like stuff that's coming out of foreign countries, that, you know, might not be hitting the national media here, stuff like that. Whenever there's protests, I always go to look for footage because inevitably somebody will post video footage on Twitter. Whenever we have an event like, you know, a police shooting and a controversy over that in America, that video will always hit Twitter pretty early on. You know what I mean? So I'm always surfing it for that kind of news. And I got to tell you something very weird that's happening with international news. If you're looking for information on China or Italy or Ukraine, and I don't know who's responsible for this, Mike, prepare yourself for what I'm about to say. But what they do is they then flood you and troll you with a bunch of stuff when you go to search for it that is a much more intense feed of pornography that used to exist on Twitter, but before Elon Musk bought it, they kind of cleaned out a lot of the porno. They kind of cleaned out. Remember when they were cleaning out all those bots? I guess the porno was being run by the bots. So stuff was really cleared out. Like, you didn't get all this huge porno. I mean, there's a lot of people that's what they do for a living. That's their online business model. I get it. And I don't object. Listen, the adult world is the adult world. Whatever, whatever. There's plenty of women on there that, you know, have a nice picture of themselves and then a link to their OnlyFans or, there's some other site too where it's like you can get personalized, you know, tell them what you want to see in your porno and they'll do it for you for a premium. This kind of thing. And then one of the weirdest things to happen is remember the woman who, said that she identified as black and she was working for the NAACP. And it turned out that, quite frankly, biologically, she was definitely not an African-American woman. Remember that Rachel Dazdall or whatever her name was?
Barely.
Okay, well, at a certain point when she lost her job because, you know, they fired her from the NAACP or she stepped down, whatever, she was on Twitter trying to sell foot fetish pictures on OnlyFans, okay? I mean, like, this is something you can do if you don't want to go hungry. I guess it happens. But what's weird is you go and try and search for stuff like to find out about the protests in China right now or the protests in Iran or what's happening on the ground in Palestine or Ukraine or any place where there is a geopolitical structure that is being challenged and there is, you know, a conflict of nations and you go to find rarefied footage. Sometimes they derail you into these porno feeds, which weren't there not too long ago. The pornography seemed to have been cleaned off of Twitter a lot, right? I mean, much like what they did with Tumblr. Now nobody goes to Tumblr anymore because apparently Tumblr was only for porno, I guess. I don't know. I had a Tumblr account, and I was always wondering why it never worked very well. I think it's because Tumblr was mainly for porno, and I didn't know it. But I'm getting porno feeds when I'm going to look for what's going on in China. I'm getting porno feeds when I'm going to look for what's going on with Russia. Or even when I was trying to search for stuff a little different from what the mainstream is feeding us about the Brittany Griner thing today. Yeah, porno. Okay.
Well, I mean, I read something saying that, I mean, after he bought it, he fired all these people. Mm-hmm. And supposedly, you know, it's like a skeleton crew running it, and they don't have enough people to police
all this stuff.
Police all this stuff, and probably what's happening when you're looking at China or Russia is that those governments don't want you to see stuff, so they're flooding it themselves with porno.
Yeah, that's what I think is, I can't confirm that, but that's what it looks like.
That,
you know, you go to look up what's going on with Putin and outside of what they want to show you on RT, like today, because of the prisoner exchange, that guy's mother, the guy who was accused and convicted of selling weapons that were meant to kill Americans, whatever that story was, that guy. Well, anyway, Victor, whatever his name was, who's being exchanged for Brittany Griner. Well, you go to look for that. Yeah, you can find his mother on Russian television praising Vladimir Putin. Thank you for getting my son home. You know, stuff like that. But then you try and delve a little deeper into it, and yeah, it's flooded with, here's Russian chicks giving you, you know, pictures and short videos of stuff, and, yeah. So I don't know what that, and like I said, I go to look at China, because there's protests, you know, in Shanghai and various provinces that we've heard about. You know, they're holding up the blank pieces of paper. We heard about it generally in the West, but I don't trust the CNNs, MSNBCs, or the Foxes to show us real footage, right? You know, sometimes they show us recycled crap, and they show us what they want us to see. So I wanted to see the raw stuff, and I know there's a Chinese account.
Well, yeah, well, what's happened to me is I've the people I follow are, I mean, it's just disgusting. It's all like, it's just
no, it's really bizarre. Look, the people that I follow, it looks like some of them are losing their minds. I don't know what's going on, and some people are claiming that their accounts are being hijacked and this and that. But it seems as though security has gone down. The bit of a filter on keeping the porno down is gone.
Well, I'm going to tell you, like, the thing about Twitter, I've never really built a huge I never tried to build a huge following on there myself.
Right.
But I have used it and tweeted or whatever. And in the financial world, it's big. Mm-hmm. Or has been. It's easy to post charts. It's easy to use, and a lot. I mean, honestly, Twitter and Facebook, I believe, well, there's many factors, but I think they've really hurt my, not that it really necessarily matters, but I used to have a stock trading business of selling a pay service. And I think those things have really hurt that business niche by making all this information for free.
Well, see, they're good marketing tools. Here's the problem with them. They're good marketing tools, but irresponsible people have turned around and turned it into a flooded zone of crap when it comes to a lot of niche businesses. And
with there is an article before Musk bought it. I think there's all sorts of problems before he bought it. Mm-hmm. So, but before he bought it, I read a story that said that, internally, their statistics showed, and this is happening to Facebook, there's less engagement, on Facebook. But the engagement levels on Facebook supposedly started to decline a year ago, and what the studies show is that these are their studies is that there's basically, I don't know what the percentage is, but a hardcore group of people, a percentage that use Twitter and are basically completely addicted to it.
Right.
Nonstop using this thing and looking at it. And that's where they make all their money. It's not, that's not that shocking. It's sort of how these things work. But, last year, some of these hardcore people began to leave Twitter, and the internal studies were thinking that they were being turned off by the explosion that's now gone, but was there in advertisements for cryptocurrencies. That while crypto people, you know, are interested in it, people that don't believe in it, they just think it's endless scamming, which it basically is. And, but this was turning off a lot of people, and they just left the platform.
Well, right.
And there's some other category ads. I don't remember what it was.
Well, there's weird stuff
that was making people angry.
Yeah, there's a shifting thing. Like on Twitter, I'm constantly being, you know, sent these, hey, look, you got message requests. And a lot of them are, again, look, I'm not trying to stick to the pornography issue, but a lot of them are, I got my private cam thing like they do on Skype, you know. Oh, I'm 20. They're always 24. They just finished university. They're in some foreign country. And, oh, by the way, I'm lonely and bored. You know, they do that. But also there's this new wave of, we have jobs to offer you. Would you like some work in your area? Have you seen those? Because That is apparently a new thing. I don't know. When you see 10,000 people do it, you start to think, well, they must be getting something out of it if the 10,000 people are doing it. I mean, most people are not going to waste their time utilizing a marketing tool like social media unless they've been told that it has some success rate. So I'm imagining that the scamming, the phishing, the weird sort of, hey, click on this thing. And, you know, for one reason or another, they're enticing you either, again, for jobs or whatever. And in a lot of cases, they are, you know, taking your account or, you know, cracking your password or this or that. Facebook went through that for a little while. And now, yeah, it got flooded with crypto. And I think all of this happened after the void that came from, look, they eliminated a lot of bots. They kicked, you know, the Alex Joneses of the world off of a bunch of platforms. They kicked Trump off of the platforms, which, I'm sorry, I hate to say it, but he was a primary driver for people's eyes going to Twitter every day, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So as soon as he was gone, it became a marketing tool for this other creature. And this is, these things come and go as trends, it appears to me.
Yeah. Oh,
and,
yeah.
So the financial markets and the legitimate stuff like you used to do got replaced by, hey, listen, I want you to sign up for Robinhood because I'm going to get you free stock. Remember that? It was like,
yeah.
I forget what it was, $5 or $10 you get for free worth of stock, which, I mean, you know, isn't much or anything, but free is free, right? And then there were people trying to offer, listen, we're going to give you crypto for free. Maybe it's not Bitcoin, but it's this coin or that coin, or, and that's another thing nobody's talking about. What happened to Dogecoin?
That's just garbage. Well, it's right? Musk garbage. It's a Musk toy.
Yeah.
He screwed people in it and whatever. But the Musk fans don't want to talk about that.
Yeah. Well, no. See, ignore that because Elon Musk is your savior. He's going to be a bastion of free speech.
Well, that's
right?
Becoming that for people. the thing about Twitter, yeah. Though, you know, when I first got on Twitter, the thing that was amazing about it, you know, 2016, I think, was when the social media really started to take off.
Right.
You know, I could have gotten on Twitter in 2012. I don't remember what the year was. But 2015, 2016, that's when it really started to take off as a phenomenon. And, you know, time goes by and, you know, these platforms, mm-hmm. the way they're designed, you know, you're writing one or two sentences, they're designed that in a way that if you want to write something and get attention, the easiest way to do it is to insult people or insult somebody.
Oh yeah.
And be a troll. And in the tone of the thing, you know, doesn't take, at least what I see, doesn't take but seconds to see someone doing that
right.
Whenever I load it up. And I will say, I, in 2015, 2016, would argue with people on these platforms too. Now I've gotten bored of doing it and don't think it's productive. And
it's just a giant waste of time.
It's just a giant waste of time. Yeah. And I think it's ridiculous at this point.
Like
there
are still people
out of it.
Yeah. No, and there, you should burn out on it eventually because even today there are still people that go, well, I go on the forums when it comes to this topic or that topic.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what forums are you talking about? And what they're talking about are these Facebook groups still. You know, and I'm like, how are you still engaging in that considering you see how useless it is? You see that you're being, you know, manipulated by, you know, fake accounts, people that are hiding behind, you know, anonymity, et cetera. And the whole weird thing to me is, do you remember, and here I go with the grandpa, do you remember section of the show, right, everybody? But do you remember years ago the hot or not thing that was out there?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah, well, you know, from what I understand, that was what Zuckerberg started with.
Yeah, that's what I understand, too.
I didn't know that at the, you know, obviously.
A clone of it, I think.
A clone of it.
That very site.
Or maybe it was that site. But either way, all it was these pictures of these women. And it was like, or men, you know, I guess you could choose men if you wanted to. But either way, you chose what you wanted to look at. And then you told the algorithm who was hot and who was not basically. Okay. And they gave you a scale to work with. And then eventually it evolved into, well, maybe, you know, you can contact them or they can contact you. And then the whole Facebook thing happened. And look, there's a lot of controversy over whether he actually, you know, did he steal it from the, what were they, the Vanden Bosch twins or Vanden whatever?
Yeah.
All right. Whatever. Either way. You know, it's very interesting to me that they created this sort of, you know, very basic sort of prurient interest thing. And it evolved into this mess where, frankly, what turned me off to Facebook at a certain point and really just shut it down, it was interesting to me at first, is that people would write these book-length manuscripts on there, and I had no interest in half of this crap, and I would get flooded with garbage from these people that were just insanely ranting, just looking to do what you're talking about with these shorter bursts of, let me see if I can insult people and get a reaction, right? But they would write these massive long things on there. And I was saying to myself, this is too much. I actually started to prefer Twitter and discovered that it did have better reactions. Like, as a marketing tool, I could say something on Twitter and get people to show up on a website, right? And things like this. So I said, oh, look, it works much better than Facebook does. And I don't have to be annoyed by people constantly messaging me. They don't do it as much on Twitter. I don't know why. And because you're limited to the amount of characters and space you can take up, it seems to me as though they have to be at least pithy about their attempts to incite things, right? So they can't just drone on and on and on and on. And all that, I thought it was a better alternative. But it's weird because as these things keep shifting, I'm just discovering that it's nothing but a massive tool. Yes, you can use it as a marketing tool, but on the other hand, the majority of what it's used for, the majority of its life's blood, is precisely what you're talking about, the trolling aspect of it. It's people's reactions and their grievances being aired one way or another, or supposed grievances, and the reactions to it. That is the majority of it. And even today, it's weirder even still, because nowadays, what would your newscast be like without social media? Because half of the news stories are based on, well, we saw this on social media. This person made a statement. Like, in other words, this replaced press releases. This replaced how can you learn about what's going on in your community?
Yeah.
This replaced,
well,
yeah.
I've been looking at local news. The local news world a lot, and right. You know, they're police departments and county governments that Facebook is the main way they reach people, especially the police departments and sheriff departments.
Right.
I mean, they are posting things on Facebook and nowhere else. I mean, that's what I see. But the thing about Twitter in this whole phenomena, but Twitter in particular, Twitter's got a lot of journalists on it and television figures and so forth. So with the financial markets, what I was following were people from that world, the stock traders, financial media figures, and then also libertarian people. And so that's who the two categories of people that were dominating my feed. And, with the stock market, when I was getting on this thing, I could talk to people that are CNBC, producers, media figures, and they would reply. And,
a guest who would show up on Jim Cramer or Jim Cramer himself, it didn't matter, right?
They've got a show, called Fast Money that comes on, comes on at 5 o'clock. And there's these guys on there that got ponytails and they're brothers. Mm-hmm. And this show, it's the design of the show. It's what they have to do. You create the audience, you got to deliver, but they spit out constant stock picks and trading ideas. And they're almost always bullish on the stock market. Well, several years ago, they had a guest on their show, that someone who has a newsletter that I've emailed before and I know people that know the person. Mm-hmm. And he was a guest on their show, and they just had him on there to give like a rare contrarian opinion. And the guy's on their show, and he's not saying anything unreasonable, and they immediately ganged up on him and smeared him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on Twitter, I was mad about that, and I, you know, wrote back to these people that it was inappropriate to invite someone on their show
mm-hmm.
and then smear them. And then I was saying they're wrong about what they're saying, and got into an argument with them. And next thing I know, they are acting like they want to fight, like they're tough guys or something. Like,
yeah.
You use this crazy language. You know, these people are in New York City. I mean, it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, they're writing back to me, you know, these people on television. So what it's just, on one hand, it gives you that sort of situation. Can give you a sense of empowerment. Here, mm-hmm. I can talk back to the great men on the television box, you know, but it's also completely ridiculous.
Look, even I have been tempted and have participated in, you know, complaining to people that I've watched their program. Hey, what the hell's the matter with you? You know, and occasionally they do respond, which is funny. So it has created a sense of empowerment among a lot of people and all that too, but it is very, very false, very, very strange.
Yeah, yeah, and, well that's...
Yeah, and the keyboard commandos that are tough guys on there just crack me up to no end. But anyway, I got Mike Swanson with me. We've so far been dissecting, the Twitterverse, but who knows what we'll get to in the next segment here on the Ocelli Effect. Stick around. We'll be back after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Support Chuck Ocelli at Chili.com.
There's no money in it, so.
Yeah, that is
the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And, you know, some people would say that, look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but, quite frankly, I'm on that business model too, and, look, I'm not gonna complain, but I'm gonna complain. Okay, because people want to support you, they love you to death, but honestly,
so if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show, and I want you to do this because you know, the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
Thank you. chili.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Second segment of the Thursday Ocelli Effect is live now, but of course, if you're hearing the podcast, it's not live, and welcome no matter what. So here we are, and Mike Swanson is with me, and we were talking about the Twitter sphere, and we might have to talk about it just a little more, because Mike mentioned that, you know, he likes to follow, and I do this too. I follow interesting characters sometimes, not even people that I necessarily agree with, but I love to follow some of the libertarian figures on Twitter and stuff. I certainly follow politicians. That's another interaction point that we didn't mention, is that, you know, directly, look, follow your congressman, your senator on Twitter. Follow Nancy Pelosi on Twitter. We know how that's gone for some people. Okay. Et cetera, right? So, I mean, access to people that normally you'd have to go out of your way to find access to, and people that maybe aren't necessarily being heard from in the major, you know, media circles and corporate media. And Mike and I both will follow libertarian people who are thinkers or who say things or make commentaries about stuff that is certainly outside of the left-right normal paradigm. I mean, frankly, I follow some anarchists and stuff on there, too. A lot of them not really speaking up as much as they used to, because they keep getting lumped in with things like Antifa, or maybe they're part of the anti-government conspiracies, or blah, 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 because they always do that to anarchists. I mean, that's been like the past 100 years, Mike. You know, they use the word anarchist to blackball people and just go, all right, well, this guy's dangerous, he's anti-government, et cetera, et cetera. And meanwhile, it could be all about the you know, non-aggression principle, et cetera, and maybe we just don't need the kind of leadership that is so expansive and loaded with bureaucracy and all that, where they might be, you know, somebody who says, we don't need all this. Doesn't mean that they're trying to take down the government. They just don't think it's all necessary. And, oh, wait a minute. That brings us into common ground with a whole lot of these people that used to be called libertarian, although it's kind of a dirty word in some circles anymore. But these are always interesting people on the social medias. And, indeed, they found a way to grow even during these different phases where the marketing tool was useful to alternative thinkers and alternative, oh, dare I say it, media, right? I mean, so what about that part of it? What about how that has sort of emerged? And clearly, look, I'm not talking about the nutcases out there or whatever, but, I mean, the real alternative sort of, you know, people who are thinking outside of the normal paradigms or the given acceptable, well, you know, relative trains of thought that you're supposed to get on board with. You know, are you for the mask or are you against the mask? Oh, here we go again. Pick a side. Pick a side. Some people might have a more nuanced view, and they can get it out there via these social media platforms. And I know you and I will both follow people like that just to see what they're saying. Yes or no?
Well, what I'm seeing, though, the libertarian movement, the Libertarian Party, it's kind of, the party got taken over. So, there's a lot of, last year there was a battle inside, I guess you could say, the libertarian movement, and the Libertarian Party itself, it got taken over by something called the Mises Caucus, which includes Tom Woods is one of the leaders of it. And from what I can gather on Facebook, reading his comments, someone that's been a guest of your show, David Beto, or Beto, how do you pronounce his name?
I think it's Beto, but
Beto, yeah, that, you know, he was supporting people on the losing end of this. And the Mises Caucus people are kind of what they did when they took it over, as they said, we don't support all of the far-right cultural warriors in the so-called alt-right, but we want them in the party. We welcome them into the party.
Yeah.
So they all came into the party. Now, someone I would say is a friend of mine ran as in that in the last election for the Republic for the Libertarian nomination, Jacob Hornberg, I'm speaking of. Mm-hmm. And these Mises Caucus people were supporting him, but he lost. And some of them got angry at him because he, you say these things on your show, but he's, well, he would say this. He's very, uncompromising. He won't change his views. And he will say he wants to abolish Social Security and right. Medicare. And he also doesn't want any tariffs. And he doesn't think there should be immigration restrictions. In his view, the government should be basically as small as it possibly can and doing nothing.
Well, and you can see that stuff publicly at the Future for Freedom Foundation, which he publishes his thoughts all the time. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. So that's what he's always said, but they got angry at him because they thought, some of them, that by saying these things, he was turning people off and they wanted to appeal to more people. And being for immigration or being against immigration restrictions is not something that is attractive to the modern day conservative movement.
Yeah, the current strain of the libertarian. See, that's the thing about this.
He's a libertarian. His message, he hasn't changed probably since the 70s.
Right.
And these people are trying to rebrand the libertarians to appeal to basically the alt-right or Trump people, basically.
Yeah, but this is what the problem is.
He wasn't doing it. So they basically, he lost, and then they don't have nothing to do with them, and then they took over the Libertarian Party. But the reason this is important is that, it appears they have some backing of or allies with people such as Elon Musk and Peter Thiel.
Right.
And I mean, I can, for example, there is an Arizona Senate race and there's a libertarian candidate that this party was supporting that dropped out and then said, vote for Blake Masters, who was Peter Thiel's person, worked for him and was his candidate. And so now when I see Musk buying Twitter, I'm seeing all these people just constantly praising him. Constant. I mean, I'm talking like every hour they are tweeting praising him. And it's just like really crazy. I mean, to me, it's really crazy. You know, I mean, I'm not going on social media and just writing something every hour praising somebody. It's just creepy.
No, it's very weird. And look, when you got this narcissistic sort of billionaire out there, you know, I mean, you have to constantly praise him. I mean, that's the problem we saw with Trump too. But let's rewind on this libertarian thing, because it's fascinating to me. The Libertarian Party, as introduced to me, all right, in the early 90s, when I first, you know, got to be a voting age, right? 1990. Yeah, I was 18 in 1990. Okay. So the thing is, that Libertarian Party doesn't even exist now, right? It is the various flavors of different alt-right type of philosophies now, right? I mean, there's sort of like a classic libertarian, which Jacob is pretty much one of those guys in my mind. You know, drug prohibition, it's stupid. End it. You know, I mean, like, you want to put a stop to, you know, the corruption with the government and how it interferes with stuff, just take government's hands off of things. Done. That is the way it was, okay? And believe it or not, libertarians were often more compared with the left wing of our political spectrum here back in the 90s. Do you remember that? Where it was sort of like, it's almost like a lefty thing, but a little weird, right?
Yeah.
And but here's the thing. The fact that they want to welcome in more people, and they say they do, but they only want to welcome in more of a certain kind of people because they saw that they could be weaponized by a guy like Trump. They saw that they could be useful, okay, in stirring things up and getting a lot of attention. They figure, look, this is the way forward, so we stop getting 1.5% of the vote. I pointed out here in Georgia, you know, Ted Metz, who ran for governor the last time, okay, Kemp ran for governor, and this time he ran for, I don't know, attorney general or secretary of state, I forget which, but either way, Ted Metz is a decent guy, but he never gets more than 1% of the vote. And you would think in Georgia that a guy who is kind of classic libertarian, sort of, would get a lot more of a lot more attention and so on, but they don't get it. And even in New York, they keep switching back and forth between the left and the right, making sure that they don't even have ballot access. The Libertarian Party is constantly fighting for ballot access, and meanwhile, they're the closest thing to a legitimate third party that we have at this point in time. But ever since they got sort of taken over, and some people would trace it back to the whole Tea Party thing, right? Where you had these, very staunch right-wing conservative people come on in, take over the libertarians, and continue it forward and drive it into the ground. Cause really, if you want to go for right-wing or right-wing light, why not go with the larger party, which is the Republican Party? You don't need the libertarians to accomplish this stuff. All you need are staunch conservatives who will run under the Republican banner. You know, some people would say that Ron Paul was a great libertarian, blah, 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 blah. But you know, the problem with Ron Paul is that he's on the Republican ticket. So there was no way the Republicans were going to allow a guy like that to ascend to the top of the party. It wasn't going to happen. And people had to learn that the hard way when Ron Paul ran in, what was it, 2012, right? They had to learn it the hard way. The Republicans were not going to allow it. And if you put him on the Libertarian, he's a great figure in the Libertarian movement. But is he ever going to have the ballot access? Or no, not in this way. And they still continue to recruit the right wing into the instead of creating the brand that would be an actual alternative and a difference. And I get the Mises Caucus guys because they've always existed. I mean, it's from the von Mises Institute and that sort of line of thinking regarding economics and so on. And I mean, you know, anybody who listens to this show is probably already familiar with that. But my point about it is that because they allowed the right wing to infiltrate and hijack everything there and they, you know, shrunk away from really establishing a truly different sort of brand, it's very easy to have them lost among, well, gee, if you're going to go right wing, why not go with the majority party, the one that's not necessarily as extreme? And this is how these guys lose. I mean, unless you think I'm analyzing this the wrong way, it just seems to me as though they keep doing it and they keep coming up with new ways to do it. And new people come in, whether it's Tea Party or Mises. Yeah, go ahead.
I was looking at this 2 or 3 weeks ago, what was going on with this Libertarian Party and this Mises Institute thing. I was looking at who's trying to figure out where the money's coming from and this and that. But one of the conclusions I came to isn't about them specifically. Look, for the past 2 years, I've gotten involved a little bit in local politics where I live.
Right.
And basically, I'm working with people in the Republican Party locally, okay?
Yeah, but you're not running for office. I mean...
No, I'm not running for office.
Mike, no offense, but I do not see you as the guy who wants to run for office, right?
No. But...
okay, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
I'm not right. But the thing about it is that I don't, these third parties, whether it's the Libertarian Party or the Green Party or any of the others, I don't think they're viable at all. I think they're almost like scams. I don't think they can win. I don't think they can do anything. And
well,
and
they're not offering. They're not offering an actual alternative. Well, that's there's the nothing problem. They can.
Yeah, they're not offering. They're not right. They're not offering. They're not saying they can do anything. They're not telling you they can do anything. They're just running on sort of like a brand, basically, the libertarian brand or this Green Party brand. You know, we're this kind of like brand. We're not Democrat. If it's the Greens, we're not Democrats. We're more pure. Both of them say that basically. But in the real world, if you actually want to do something, what I've taken from what I've seen in the past 2 or 3 years is you have to work. I don't think the thing to do is to focus on these parties or Republican or Democrat for that matter either, but on specific local issues or some sort of organization outside, that's devoted to an issue you care about that then pressures the politicians, or you join a labor union or something or some organized group. But I just don't think if you want to get involved in politics, the Libertarian Party or the Green Party is any way to actually accomplish something, unless you just want to get one of these things for your own self-aggrandizement or something. That's the conclusion I come to.
Well, just, because they never seem to be attached to specifics is the problem, right? I wind up bringing these guys on the show, some of them. And you know, I brought libertarian candidates on the show. And in a lot of cases, I go, okay, well, what are the specifics, though? What are you going to do? You know, let's just go with the theoretical. But for some reason, they hate everybody else so much that they're going to go with you right now. What is it that you're going to do if you're the lone libertarian who steps into the governor's mansion, the town council, what are you going to do?
Say, like, yeah. With Hornberger's case,
yeah.
He ran before, for the libertarian nomination, lost. He also ran a long time ago in the state of Virginia for Senate. And the candidate, it was a very strange race. It was when I was in college, and that one candidate was a Republican. I think it was John Warner, and there was no real Democrat. The woman that was running was a LaRouche candidate lady, and so it was really Hornberger as a Libertarian, this LaRouche woman, and the Republican. And I remember reading Hornberger in an interview. I mean, I didn't know him at the time, but he was saying he was running not because he thought he could win, but as to educate people. It's like educating people in libertarianism. So, and that's kind of his philosophy. He runs not because he thinks he's going to win, but he thinks it's an effective way to get his message out.
Well, that's clearly his mission, because
and future, I can understand that, but
yeah, no,
the idea of you're going to accomplish anything concrete, I don't think that's realistic, and therefore I don't think the parties are worth people getting deeply involved in.
Well, first of all, look, let me separate Daniel Hornberger from the rest of what I'm talking about here, because I know the guy enough to know that he really is, you know, passionately about trying to educate people about that sort of philosophy and going in that direction. And that's what he does. That's what he does all the time, whether he's running for an office or he's putting together a conference or he's putting out a newsletter or whatever. It doesn't matter. That's what he does. I know that. And if that's your point, and that's why you're going to get on the ballot, is in order to gain a little bit of attention and give people a way to look at things differently, that's seeding things for the future, and I understand that. Okay, but the people that try to sell it as this is something that, you know, again, you can begin to make things different. Right. And I understand the whole idea about ballot resistance and stuff like that. It, like the guy in New York I had on who was trying to run for governor in New York. Good guy again. I like him and I like the way he thinks and everything else. But they kept kicking these guys off the ballot in New York because neither the Democrats nor the Republicans want to allow a third party to flourish or even give a chance for somebody like Hornberger to run around and start to educate people about, you know, there might be other possibilities here. So I get it, but it's very, very weird that they keep banging their heads up against the wall with the very same thing. It's like they should stop calling that libertarian and just come out with, I don't know, the alt-right party and be done with it. You know, the Libertarian Party has lost meaning as a brand, but it's still recognizable enough that people can use it, right? I mean, that's the way I see it. And again, this is not a criticism of Daniel Hornberger. He's a legitimate, honest guy. And I can't say that about all these other people. I like I said, Ted Metz, legitimate, honest guy. I know what he's after. I know what his deal is. I know he would like a chance to be able to change things from, you know, a position of power. He's run over and over again and really legitimately wants a shot. I get it. And he also takes the time to educate people as well. And I'm sure Daniel Hornberger would love to get a shot at being able to change things from within the power structure, but he's realistic about it. That's the way I'm reading it. I don't know, Mike, but look, we're running low on time, and I got to have him back on, actually, because I recently got some something in the mail, I think, from the Future of Freedom Foundation. I got a couple of questions about it, so I might have Daniel Hornberger on the show again. But I like him. And you know what? Again, full disclosure, I met him at the JFK conference in 2017. You introduced him to me. I like Daniel. I like what he does. I don't necessarily agree with his Zapruder film ideas, but I explored them on the show too. Okay. He's an interesting guy and also has some of the same interests I do, so... I appreciate him, and I appreciate you, Mike. And, of course, I hope everybody out there does. Go over to WallStreetWindow.com. Be in the know. Get yourself informed. It's not just about Wall Street. And at all times, I highly recommend the writings of Mike Swanson, most special focus on the war state, which to me is required reading, and gives you a great idea about, the 20th century and at least part of it. To explain to you how things really worked regarding the war state. Of course, why the Vietnam War, the first in a series of three about that particular conflict. Anyways, Mike, are you going to be with us next week?
No, I'm actually won't be here, but I'll be here the week of Christmas.
Okay, so what you're telling me is, let's see, on the 16th, no Mike Swanson, but 2 days before Christmas, you'll be on the show?
Yep.
Sounds good. And in the next hour, we'll be talking to Larry Hancock and get an update on the recent events regarding the JFK Records Collection Act. So,
oh, great.
Yeah. I know
you'll, a lot of stuff happening.
I know you'll be listening. So anyway, hopefully you will out there too. Again, Mike Swanson, WallStreetWindow.com. Stick around. The Ocelli Effect continues after this.
Do you like history? Real history that you were never taught in schools? Why? The Vietnam War, Nuclear Bombs and Nation Building in Southeast Asia by author Mike Swanson with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, Nuclear Bombs and Nation Building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War by author Mike Swanson.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
The views expressed by callers, co-hosts, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ocelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ocelli.com or Chuck Ocelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue. Thank you.
News, entertainment, and more. You will learn something, children's. Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
The third segment of the Ocelli Effect, now on Ocelli.com and in the variety of other places where you can hear the podcast broadcast, etc., etc. Welcome to it. So, without any sort of delay, let's get to Larry Hancock. I am a little bit late, a little bit behind the time tonight, but, you know, again, the podcast, you're not going to care. Anyways, what do I want to talk to Larry about? Well, first of all, you know, I was just informed before I got Larry on the line that author David Lipton died. So I don't know if that, you know, total confirmation on that, not necessarily true, but apparently there is a thread on the education forum about it. It seems as though there's more than one source, okay, saying that he has passed away. In case you don't remember, he would be the author of Best Evidence. And regardless of what anybody thinks about that book, it was one of those things that caused people to get interested around the 20th anniversary, around the 15th anniversary, I think even. But the 20th and 25th anniversary, definitely, I used to hear about this all the time. The guys that I got involved with immediately when I got into researching the case, it was like they all cited Best Evidence as one of the things that, I don't know, inspired them to start to look for themselves. You know, he put out that book. There were several versions of it and the videotape and all that. So anyway, I want to note that. And why am I noting that? Because we are going to talk about JFK and what's going on with the Assassination Records Review Board stuff. The press conference occurred on Tuesday. And, you know, that was at the National Press Club and sponsored by Mary Farrell Foundation. Jefferson Morley did a presentation. Bill Simpich was there. There was an interesting guy with the statistics. I forget his name off the top of my head, but who took some polls and things like that. And it was an interesting time, and I will make further attempts to get Bill Simpich on the show because he's the lead attorney in the case. Oh, what case? Right. The Biden administration is being sued. Why? Because non-compliance with the JFK Records Collection Act. Oh, wait a minute. You know what? The Trump administration kind of didn't comply with the JFK Records Collection Act, or at least that's what it appears as though is going to be asserted in court, that the executive branch maybe not doing its job. Oh, and the National Archives maybe not following through on the thing that they were supposed to be compelled to do regarding releasing those documents. Well, I'll leave it open-ended for a moment and ask Larry, how you doing tonight, sir?
I'm fine, Chuck. It's great to be back. Just moving right along. And as you say, it's been a very interesting week, you know, following up on the legal action and then with the press club meeting, and which got a great deal of media coverage. We were very pleased with that. There were just numerous articles. You know, the lawsuit had gotten some attention, but one of the things that happened is the people that were doing the lawsuit and taking questions about it, the common response, the question they were getting from the press was, well, I can't really write a story with any guts to it if you guys don't give me some idea of what might be in those records. You know, why is this worth the effort? And so, you know, the press conference was intended to give them an example of one or two things that are there that could make a real difference. And it did that. So, mm-hmm. You know, the press conference really was to answer the question that we had been getting from the press about why are you spending the time and money to do this?
Well, why does it matter? What could we possibly learn? And of course, anybody who is reasonably sober about it would tell you that, look, and even Jefferson Morley noted, I don't like the phrase smoking gun, right, during the presentation. And I would say the same thing. I hate that phrase because it's been so overused and it's become, you know, cliche on top of cliche. I'm done with it. But, you know, what do you have here? If you have people that want to assert according to the official story, even though the official story is not necessarily the official story because we have two kind of contradictory conclusions that are both official, according to the U.S. government, right, regarding the assassination of John F. Kennedy, where you have the Warren Commission concluding a lone nut pulled this off and another lone nut killed him, okay? And then you have the House Select Committee saying that, sorry, but, yeah, the lone nut's involved, but he's not alone because it is very likely there was a conspiracy. Oh, and we're going to refer this to the Justice Department and nothing happens, okay? So we do have that case where there are slightly two different official conclusions, but let's not convolute the issue. Essentially, if you're telling us that there's a lone nut and his name was Lee Harvey Oswald and he pulled this off, that's all fine and dandy. But how about the claims that he may or may not have been connected to a government agency? How about the claims that he may or may not have been part of an operation? Do we know for certain that he was or was not? Well, could that be answered in these documents? Could it? Is it answered in these documents? Do we know for certain what's in them? Well, we don't know for certain, because if we did, we would have released it already, right? But we do have an idea, and I think Morley, in a very lengthy presentation, made a fair argument that you have evidence that that contradicts this story, that Lee Harvey Oswald is just, you know, some loser who wanted to get himself in the history books. He's clearly something more to people in the intelligence community, one way or another. Or am I mischaracterizing this, Larry?
No, that's exactly it. And I think the question that the... As you say, I'm totally done with the smoking gun thing again, because let's face it. If you are presenting a case that no legitimate criminal investigation was done, that there was obstruction, that there was obfuscation, that there was cover up, then you really are kind of, no, there's no smoking gun because they didn't let us find one. You know, you're left with that. It's like, yeah, could have been, but from what we see at this instance, things were so screwed up that we'll never know for sure because they didn't do the job that should have been done. Mm-hmm. And why would it be that? Which takes us to the question that you just brought up. Why wouldn't they not do the job right? Why would we not have full transparency? What could have kept the CIA or the FBI or for either White House, literally, from doing the job that they should have done in terms of a true criminal investigation? And that's what Jeff tried to give one example of. I mean, we actually have several examples of, but intuitively, you've got to say if one or more government agencies had a great deal of knowledge about Oswald and didn't want that to become public, if they were actually doing an operation even unwittingly around Oswald and his name and the legend that he created in New Orleans, you know, would that keep them from bringing everything forward? It looks like it could well be. So Jeff was really trying to answer the secondary question, which is why would they still keep all these documents either partially redacted or not even available if there was no issue, especially around Lee Oswald?
Well, and that's the bottom line issue with it, which is, again, if it's just some random weird occurrence where, you know, a disgruntled, confused kid, again, 24 years old when he's dead, a disgruntled, confused kid, former Marine, takes a shot and gets lucky and kills the president. Okay? The Gerald Posner solution, for lack of a better term. All right? If that's all there is, then what do you need to cover it up for? Is there embarrassment there because the agency should have known? Is there this guy slipped through their fingers? Well, if that's the case, you know, look, you can't admit a mistake 6 decades later. No, maybe there's something more there, right? And if that's the case, why not bleed it out little by little and say, look, there were mistakes made? You know, see, this is where we're stuck, right?
Well, it is, and I think Jeff brought up one point right at the beginning. To say that literally it is provable at this point in time that senior CIA officers lied to the Warren Commission. Mm-hmm. I mean, when they went officially on record as saying that the CIA had virtually no information about Lee Oswald and he was essentially an unknown quantity to them, they had nothing current, you know, that's provably a lie. We have plenty of documents and plenty of sources to say that. So we're not talking about the CIA just passively, you know, not providing information. We're talking about them overtly and proactively lying about what they knew Lee Oswald. Right. I think a point that Jeff knows quite well, since he helped surface it, was we also have a statement from a CIA essentially intelligence security officer, he himself questioned, who said, look, I'm looking at the documents you're showing me about Lee Oswald, and what they're telling me is there was some sort of a compartmental operation going on around at least his name. Right. I mean, we have that. That's on record. So, I mean, obviously some people would like to dodge this, but there was provably something going on around Lee Oswald and his identity that the CIA, and there are other agencies that one could bring up too. I mean, you and I both discussed that the FBI actually destroyed and altered documents
right
pertaining to Lee Oswald and their associating, when Jeff didn't even try to go into that one. So it's not passive. It's not that somebody is just making a bureaucratic mistake and not finding records or providing them. There's something that was more aggressive going on about covering up information related to intelligence agency knowledge of Lee Oswald.
Well, and in a direct way, I know this is old hat to you, but I mean, look, in a direct way, we don't just have, you say it's not passive. It goes further than that because the second investigation, the second major investigation, the House Select Committee, you know what I'm going to bring up here. We have somebody who has knowledge of Oswald because of his duties back when Oswald was alive. being injected into the House Select Committee investigation. George Joannides. Okay, now, Morley, you know, has sued over and over again. And one more time, I'm going to mention to you that I think that lawsuit was actually killed by a guy named Brett Kavanaugh, you know, the guy who's on the Supreme Court now, you know, in its last stages. But Morley, for years and years, was suing the CIA to get documents on George Joannides, who, again, was sent as a liaison. I mean, again, correct me where I'm wrong here, was sent as a liaison to the House Select Committee for the CIA. And, again, another provable lie, because this guy's responsibilities put him in exactly the right place to know about the operations surrounding Oswald that were in his proximity and Oswald. And he's just, you know, oh, no, I don't know anything about this case. I'm just here as liaison, you know. And we discover that that's, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and I think he was there as liaison and to provide advice. I mean, he's supposed to be a resource, okay?
Yeah.
Because they're looking for sources of information on Lee Oswald. And so, you know, we're not, again, not talking about just a passive thing. It's sort of like, well, you know, who might help us understand who Oswald might have come in contact? Where could we look for records? And Joannides does not tell them, oh, yeah, I was the case officer for that group that Oswald was contacting in New Orleans, and they were making these reports, and maybe we should all get together and go look at what, you know, the DRE was saying about Oswald and propaganda that they were doing with him. Maybe we should go collect that. You know, that would have been the kind of contribution that you would expect from a resource liaison that's being provided. No, Joannides not only did that, it's sort of like he just, you know, I don't see, yeah, that's passive to some extent, but, you know, that's like, wait a minute. No, that goes beyond the pale. He had information that he was legally and, you know, ethically required to share with them, and he chose not to do it.
Right.
Knowing full well. So again, there's got to be some reason. That would be easy. I mean, if there was nothing there, it's kind of like, yeah, sure, let me help you. I know those guys, and I know what they might have. Let's go get those documents, and you'll see. Yeah, there's nothing there.
But he
did not do that.
Right. Which in one case, look, if there was a guy who had no familiarity with this stuff and was brand new and said, look, I'm not informed on this, but I'll go look. You know, you'd say, okay, fine. But this is a guy who is informed on these things that would have been relevant, clearly obstructing the investigation because he did not do that. I mean, it's just, how do you view it another way? And meanwhile, as I said, Morley, up until very recently, was just trying to get documentation on Joannides. And they wouldn't give it to him. I mean, there's a whole story behind that, and he's written about it extensively. But I just found it interesting that that was mentioned during this press event as well. Because it is a clear demonstration of, you know, of the active and informed cover-up of a government agency about what it is they could have contributed to the record. Now, let's fast forward a little. Assassination Records Review Board. Okay, established in 92. So you have George H.W. Bush, excuse me, signing it into law, right? And Bill Clinton puts together the review board. Okay, government agency established within the executive branch, etc. People have heard me say this before. All right. And then 25 years later, because, look, there needs to be a little more time before we release some documentation. Coincidentally, 2017, which I'm very sure nobody foresaw that Donald Trump would be president at the time, but there you go. That's who was in control of the executive branch when that time expired. 25 years later, Larry, they're supposed to release this stuff, right? And a bunch of things that had been curated by the Records Review Board. I mean, and of course, Morley also points out, and so do others, including Simpich, point out that there were plenty of records requests that were incomplete at the time that the Assassination Records Review Board, or some people are referring to it as the ARB, you know, closed shop. There was some incomplete work. But let's put that aside and just say, look, the work that was completed, though, we have all these documents that were supposed to come out. So 2017 comes, and there are specific ways in which the government agencies could ask for an extension, even though, you know, it's been, let's see, 30 years since, and then another 25, you know, 30 years since the event, 25 years past the time we start looking at this. These things are supposed to be released. Well, it's time. Hey, we need more time, says the FBI and the CIA to the Trump administration, without giving specifics, which they were required to do. Trump administration says, okay, no problem. We'll kick the can down the road. So they did. Then the Biden administration gets a hold of it and effectively does the same thing with one little extra caveat. Again, maybe I'm misunderstanding this, right? But of course they added on, we're having trouble, you know, going through all this because of COVID too. But, you know, forget about that preceding 30 years now. Okay. Cause 92 to 2022, excuse me, that's 30 years, isn't it? I mean, I don't know. Maybe my math is off.
Somebody just put it on a calendar and said, we'll work on this stuff 30 years from now. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, I'm pretty sure the pandemic was not that long. It seemed like forever, but no, I don't think so.
Not 30 years. I mean, you know, it could have seemed like five, but it wasn't. And it was only a couple, but still, look, I'll give you that there could be certain things about bureaucracies that had trouble running, but how about that previous 2.5 decades? I mean, you couldn't have gotten this done in between then and then? No? Okay. Yeah, just checking. Point is,
well, Chuck, let me give you one example that Jeff didn't really have a chance to go into, but
please do.
Yeah, 30 years. Okay, let's take 30 years. Let's take one person and one set of documents.
Okay,
we know that J. Walton Moore was a CIA domestic contacts officer who had the Fort Worth Dallas area in Texas, and we know from George Damore and Shield himself that he approached Damore and Shield and asked him to provide information on Lee Oswald when he returned to Dallas. Okay? There's nothing illegal about that. I mean, the guy's been to the Soviet Union. There's, you know, nothing illegal about doing that. But it's one relatively small set of documents that are still classified after all these decades.
Mm-hmm.
Now, considering that what we know him to have done was actually within his rights, within his the profile of the CIA domestic operations, nothing, you know, no reason to be bashful about that. And it's only, you know, a few dozen documents. Surely 30 years would have been enough time to clear that out and make it available, unless there was something in there that reveal more about the CIA's interest in Oswald and the reporting on Oswald than they want to share. I mean, that's a real concrete, small body of information that is not, there's no reason why it would be incriminating per se, or even embarrassing per se. It would be more like, oh, they were doing their job, right? Kudos to them. Yet that's still withheld.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have somebody in the chat room asking, you know, how is it that you could even be convinced that anything would be real, true, or, you know, even relevant that they're going to allow to be released at the end of this process? I get it, but here's the thing. Because of the constant looks at this, it would be so difficult to, because a lot of people go for, well, what if they just fabricated stuff, you know? And indeed, we found that they did fabricate some things. But the idea that we could find that is based on the fact that there's been this constant work. Okay. So what I'm trying to explain is that the evolution that has been taking place since the 60s. Okay. Is valuable in this way. It's impossible to, out of whole cloth, create stuff today that fits with all of the other pieces that we've gotten so far. This is the problem that they have now. Is that we figured out their code names. We figured out, because we've had help from a lot of different people, about how the filing system works, about exactly what this document means. We've had a lot of help. So collectively, it's very difficult for something to be fabricated out of thin air. Okay? As far as things being destroyed, well, we know that there have been things destroyed. But we're aware of that, and we're able to be aware of that because of this constant work. Okay, again, it drives some people crazy who are just looking for where's the ultimate answer. I get it. But there is a reason for it, okay? So I know it's very difficult. It's a long slog. It really is. And when they make you drag for 30 years just to get some documents that, of course, people were upset weren't being released in the 90s, you know, a lot of people have passed on. A lot of people are gone. A lot of people have retired. A lot of people have given up. I get it. But there is a purpose for this. And eventually, yeah, they always wind up releasing things. And they brought it up during this press conference, too, the Northwoods document. Okay, which, again, you have to credit to the Records Collection Act, because you might have never seen it. And it is awfully interesting when one is trying to understand the way things are planned out, thought of, explored, okay, when it comes to covert operations. Or do you disagree with any of that, Larry?
No, I think the point is that at this point in time, literally hundreds of thousands of pages of documents have been released, and we've learned an amazing amount from them. We've learned just a lot of things that are suggestive, a lot of things that are contextual, a lot of things that allow us to do fact checking. I mean, from the documents that we released, that were released, they refer to other documents. They also refer to, you have your distribution and routing information on them. You have record and memo numbers on them. And we have experts in that field. I mean, if you were going to totally create a fake document back in 1964 and insert it, you know, you could have done that. I mean, mm-hmm. quite frankly, there's no sign that that was done on a wide scale. In a couple of instances, like Oswald's notebook, the FBI did do that, okay? Mm-hmm. But one of the things is we're looking at what I would call day job documents. These are documents that had to be created in a certain context. You know, what are we doing at this day and time, at that point in history, with these things? So they have to hang together with a lot of other stuff.
Right.
Which means, you know, there's a lot of tissue, connectivity tissue involved. And so I think, why would we believe? We don't believe. We inspect and we check and we confirm. And we can do that to an extent now that the Warren Commission could never have dreamed of.
Right.
The House Select Committee couldn't have dreamed of. The ARB probably couldn't even have dreamed of doing what we do now. Here's an example on Morley's release. Mm-hmm. Because I've seen some people ask this on the Ed forums, like, well, you have some documents on Joannides. You know, Morley got some of those released. So, some, you know, don't they tell you, I mean, if somebody looked at those, would they not know enough to be able to go back and say, oh gosh, you didn't give us all this good stuff? Well, you know, the documents, well, here's what, if you look closely, for example, his performance report on Joannides says that he worked with student groups. Mm-hmm. That's the language. It doesn't say that he worked with the DRE, which is the group that Oswald connected to. Right. So even a good staff member of the ARB or HSCA may well have been, you know, it's easy to pass over. Well, I see nothing in his record that would connect him to Oswald. And no, it doesn't say DRE, which would have been a keyword. Now we know what student groups it was, and in particular, what student group he was the case of. So a lot of the documents themselves, you know, you've got to know a lot to get something out of them. And I think that needs to be expressed, because sometimes people say, oh, well, couldn't the HSC have found this, or the ARB have found something? You know, it requires context. And honestly, it's taken us this long to get to the point of where to know specifically what we're looking for. And I think, Chuck, you brought it up. It's sort of, we not only know what we're looking for, we will know if it's missing.
Yeah, that's the
thing.
And
that will be very interesting for the CIA. It's kind of like, you're not releasing this because you don't have it anymore? Why would they, you know, it's not the kind of black hole situation it was decades ago.
Well, right. Like a good, for instance, is Oswald's 201 file. And look, the fact that it existed, okay, was, you know, first of all, a little bit of a shocker to some people, and shouldn't have existed according to some statements given, right? But then we're looking at it, we figure out what should be in it, and we're asking questions about why are there things missing from this. Then you take a look at it, and, you know, the transmittal part of it, where who is checking this thing out, who's looking at it, why are they doing that, at which time are they doing it, okay? These things have all had to come together slowly because, again, like you said, the HSCA might have not understood that this guy's initials on this document has a meaning, that he actually checked it out in, you know, the summer of 63. Okay. They might not have even caught that because, look, okay, a 201 file. All right. Now we're coming to understand that a person of interest, it doesn't make you an agent to have a 201 file. Okay. You're a person of interest. But if there are certain things in there, that has a certain meaning. They are collected for a certain purpose. There are certain people that want to see this because, you know, and that stuff did not come together right away. It wouldn't have been available. See, that's the thing about, you know, when people say, oh, you know, the case was solved by somebody in 1970. I always laugh because I'm like, you didn't even understand half of what was going on in the 1970s. Okay, because over time, it's taken a collective effort, and I hate to say this, because again, it sounds like, you know, oh, well, you know, he's one of those people who adheres to the community, and no, but credit where credit's due, okay? Without contributions from people who understood certain things about the files, about the transmission of said files, the communications, I mean, simply having to learn about the telexes and things, it is not something everybody knew or understood at different times. Why is this being transmitted? Why does it get transmitted to this place? Do we even know what this facility is or was? Is this facility a place that should have even existed? Okay. Who else is, you know, a CC'd, so to speak, on this? Why? All right. Everything has a way of being understood over time. And it does take time because, again, somebody who might have been an expert on this case in 1985, 83, 20 years later, didn't necessarily know what the meaning of all these things was. 93, 2003 even, didn't necessarily know until we really started to get together and share information, as we have over the past maybe 20 years, okay? A whole lot of things were not decipherable. Or maybe I'm wrong about that, Larry.
Yeah, here's a good example. Let's go back to Joannides for a moment, okay? Until, okay, fine, we had a few records on him once Jack managed to get them. But in looking at the records, you know, you have to go through the records and kind of go, so who was he? Who did he report to? Where was he in the organization structure? What were his levels of responsibility? How well do we really know this guy and what his day job was? And it's not until you're able to profile him to that extent and say, oh, well, he wasn't just, he, you know, this is a guy who was briefing Richard Helms on the DRE because right. They had been such a problem for the CIA. Okay. He was put into the position because the DRE was kind of running its own game. Now, and so he's got a kind of a headquarters level responsibility, but then again, he's got a very senior position at JM Wave right. In Miami, where the DRE, all their officers, their headquarters, everything about the DRE is in Miami. So it takes you a while to understand who he is, what his roles are. His roles largely have to do with propaganda and political action, not maritime operations. This is all gut level stuff that nobody knew decades ago. And right. Then you stumble across something that says, well, this guy is meeting with the guys that are running the DRE, monthly. They tell us that, and he never told us that, but somebody interviews them, and okay. And then you find something in a record that says, oh, in the summer of 1963, he had a place and operated in New Orleans, mm-hmm. where there were like maybe 7 DRE members, none of them in charge of anything, none of them running any really serious activities. Why in the world would a guy with this clout and with this assignment be in New Orleans? We don't know, because we don't have, but certainly it is operationally suggestive, since it was at that point that this huge propaganda operation involving Oswald kicked off. You couldn't have known this stuff unless you understood all the players and you had an organization chart.
Well, even look, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee itself, which ends up being virtually destroyed, right? And intentionally, by guess who? Right? The people that ran a sort of counterintelligence operation against it, who laid out plans. Okay? This is how we're going to do this. It's fascinating to me that, well, Oswald's behavior and his interactions with individuals right there in public, and some of the public displays that, you know, oh, this doesn't make sense, because why would Lee Oswald do that? It's interesting that it sort of lines up with the, you know, the FPCC program that was in place at the time. Now, does that say directly that Oswald was under the control of the people that were running that program? Not necessarily, but who knows? Because he's taking some of the actions that they would suggest to infiltrate, smear, create a problem for this particular political action group. Or am I misreading that?
No, and I think you just, there's no need that Oswald has to be witting. In fact, some of the best CIA operations ever are built around unwitting characters who are doing things that are useful. I mean, you don't want to necessarily create anything from scratch. What the best, easiest thing to do is piggyback on something that's already going on. Just like you don't play spies, you recruit spies. But I think an important thing needs to be said is the FPCC, yeah, there was some intent to destroy them, but the real intent was to use them mm-hmm. for domestic propaganda purposes, like the evil minions of Cuba. You know, we want to make them look dangerous. We want to make them look seditious. We want to make them. And then what we find out, you know, this is real propaganda. This is not. This is professional level stuff. I want to use them for a purpose. Cuba is evil. Cuba is somehow recruiting good old boy young Marines who are naive to become their tools. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Right.
And so what do we find in the summer of 63? We find the DRE writing letters to American congressmen about Lee Oswald and how easily he's an example of some, you know, how Cuba can seduce and infiltrate and influence. You know, this is real propaganda.
Right.
And again, would Joannese certainly knew that the DRD was doing this. He actually interviewed a DRE officer who said, and the DRE officer says, oh yeah, we talked to him and we, you know, they were giving us $50,000 a month to do propaganda, and you know, this is an example of the propaganda we're doing with Lee Oswald. So it's inconceivable that Joannides would not have known that, mm-hmm. but it's also inconceivable that Joannides would be working for as a liaison and go, oh yeah, you know, that student group that was doing all that propaganda on Oswald, I was their case officer.
Yeah, right.
None of this connects, very well, but I had to insert that about it. It wasn't just, it was an effort built around the FPCC, not just to destroy it ultimately, but in the interim to use it. And a right. fascinating thing is we do know one other officer who in 1963 was specifically assigned into that role to actually use the FPCC as a propaganda vehicle to make it a threat throughout Central America, And to do that, they picked David Phelps, who was stationed in Mexico City. And where does he go that fall? He goes to Miami. Mm-hmm. enough of that. But I think the point is, again, I'm not sure that any of us understood how the CIA really does some of these things. You know, they were a lot more mysterious back in 1964 than they are now.
Of course. Of course. No, and my only point about it being destroyed is ultimately that's what occurred. But it's not necessarily that they wouldn't turn around and utilize something like that for a propaganda tool, as you described. I'm just saying that ultimately that's what happened. Is that, you know, pretty much, I mean, they disbanded, I think, fairly quickly. All the negative light was shown on them, because now they were, you know, a group associated with the alleged assassin. I mean, this could not have been a great recruiting tool in America at the time. You know, I'm just saying. And it was a legitimate organization. And again, let's not forget that Oswald was not legitimately part of said organization. Right? I mean, this whole thing where he's running a fake chapter, I mean, it's textbook what you do to get in the public eye and create a credibility, a legend, in order to steer that legend after. And it's not even, again, like you said, it could be an unwitting participant. Why not pick up? We talked about this a couple of weeks ago, coincidentally, about how, you know what? You pick up what's already laying there, whether it's the organized criminals or it's the political activists. It's who is available already doing the work that you kind of want them to do. And hey, you know what we could do is figure out a way to funnel them some funds, send them some extra personnel, right? You know, just kind of help them along, because they're already doing the job we want done. And that's the most efficient way to spend your resources, is, like you said, to piggyback on things that already exist. And again, we kind of covered this a couple weeks ago. When we weren't talking about Russia, we were talking about this kind of thing, right? About the craft or so. Well, that would be one way to phrase it, right? Spy craft or,
trade,
I don't know.
Craft,
trade, yes. Craft, yes. Okay, there you go. That would be the way to describe it. So anyway, I don't want to belabor these points too much more. I want to get to the ultimate conclusion here, because again, we are faced with in 7 days, right? 7 days, there is a deadline coming up, and that was the other thing that was brought up during this presser, was that the Biden administration, okay, there's a memo that says we want to get these things out there, let's get it released, we have a deadline, December 15th, okay? Now, I don't know that can't be further pushed down the road, and I assume that the lawsuit is certainly an attempt to make sure that that doesn't happen, but it appears as though the Biden administration might be willing to do so on December 15th, is actually finally allow these things to trickle out. Now, I don't know how redacted they'll be. I don't know what condition they'll be in. I don't know any of that, personally. And I always hate to speculate, because every time there's a release, I'm always disappointed, and it's never quite exactly what I think it's going to be, frankly. Okay.
But there's actually, as you say, and I think one of our lawyers, Larry, made a good point of this briefly in the presentation. Let's say that happened. Let's say that the president orders everything to be released. Mm-hmm. The lawsuit actually has three elements to it, and one of them has to do with release. However, and that's where the president is named in regard to the release, so that, you know, people can't continue appealing to the president to override the law and just go ahead and release. But there are two other elements to the lawsuit. The law itself addresses collections, and it addresses access. And I've seen some posts online about this. It's kind of like, well, some of the stuff that Jeff wants isn't even in the collections yet, so they couldn't release if they wanted to. The law actually required that the National Archives take up the mandate and duties of the ARRB. The National Archives is directed by law to pursue collections. Mm-hmm. If somebody goes to them with a reasonable, justifiable list of things that weren't collected from the agencies because we didn't know about them, or collected from the Kennedy Library, mm-hmm. or RFK, they are fully empowered to exercise mandated collections and go for them and bring them in and make them part of the total collection. Mm-hmm. So just because something was missed, and we kind of feel this is pretty much as important as the release, because they have that duty. They were empowered and directed by Congress to do that, and nobody's supposed to get in their way. They haven't been doing it. Of course, to do it, they need support from an administration. Right. Yeah, they really need support to say, okay, we don't, you know, yeah, this is your task. Go ahead and do it. We'll back you, as any agency does. But then the third element is access. Mm-hmm. And the law mandates that they will make it all accessible to the public in a reasonable time period, which they have been slow to do because of resources. We're not really picking on NARA per se. What we're really trying to do is call out that there is a major opportunity here for them to execute the full mandate that Congress gave them. Mm-hmm. If NARA will undertake it, and if they will get some support from the administration to go forward with it, you have to be reasonable about that. But it's just, if everything were released on the 15th, there's still two big elements we want to do, and that is for NARA to step up its game.
Mm. Now, one would say, okay, but what is the enforcement mechanism for this? Right, because that was always the discussion over the years before 2017. Let's just say we don't have cooperation here. How can you compel, you know, say Robert F. Kennedy's estate to comply? How could you compel? Go ahead.
That's the same problem that the ARRB did. And the point is that once something is designated as relevant to the collections, I mean, you can ask for it, which, for example, they asked for a certain set of Garrison records from New Orleans. Right. And the guy who had the records at the time said, well, I'm not going to give them to you.
Right.
What do you do? They requested materials from Kennedy's doctor, primary health care physician. And his family said, well, no, we're not going to give those to you. What recourse do you have? You have to go to court and say that these records have been deemed of value to, you know, the nation. They've been identified, and you have to show us in court why you're not going to turn them over. So it becomes a legal matter. And you do have the power, but again, that means that you have to have the staff, and you have to have the support, and you have to have the Justice Department. So yeah, there are means to go after them. Certainly some would be, going after them from the agencies is easy because the law itself lays out the criteria for what the agency has to do to object. And quite frankly, the language in the law is far stricter than FOIA. And as you said earlier, Chuck, is very specific about what they have to respond with to make a case. They have to make a case of damage.
Right.
And you can pursue that. With individuals, it's trickier. But pursuing it with agencies is pretty straightforward and is spelled out in the law. But there are means in both cases.
No, there are, but it's a little more complex when it's private hands. Does cover both public and private hands having possession of things that are relevant to the collection. So, you know, like somebody brought up, you know, is something about PBS having a photograph that they've never released, and this kind of thing. PBS is a complicated issue to some degree, but if it's relevant to the collection and it's deemed one of those things that should be in there, yeah, they should be able to take them to court and compel them to produce the document, even if it's a photograph.
Or to compel them to say why they won't. I mean, that's equally important. It's sort of like, explain to the judge why you wouldn't, this seems like a pretty innocuous thing. It's just a photo.
Right.
Or this is a report that Walter Sheridan did. He was one of your reporters, and he just did a report to you, and you're claiming that, why can't you share that? That's that, he was part of the Kennedy, why, So that's an important part of it too. To that extent, that's very much like ask the agency would have to give an explanation. Well, you'd have to give an explanation in court, and you're going to look pretty strange if, as Jeff related, you say, well, we're not giving it to you because it's our policy to support the Warren Commission. Judges probably are not going to accept that.
They shouldn't. Now, whether they will or will not, I mean, that's unpredictable, but do you want to roll those kind of dice in court? I wouldn't. But it's interesting because, again, with the government agencies, they have to show damage. And their damage, as I understand it, has to be like, look, there is a problem with national security. If we release this document, if we release this article, if we release this particular thing to the collection, to the public, there's damage that can be shown. And what's interesting there is, again, back to the argument I started with, right? Here we go. If it's just a lone nut, stupid, disillusioned kid who got lucky with a rifle, where's the threat to national security if that's what we're going to see here?
I think that's a good now, let's say that I'm the CIA and I'm you know, going to have to explain that, yes, I was operationally using Lee Oswald, and so I've been bashful about this. And we were using him to run a game against the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Mm-hmm. You know, after 60 years, it's like, then you're going to say, well, okay, that's – where's the damage there? This is no surprise to anybody. Now, if you're going to say we were using it as part of an operation to assassinate Fidel Castro, that might be another story.
Right.
But there are degrees of damage is a relative thing. So you're going to make them have to step up to say it is real damage to the, you know, the nation's image or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, look, and the idea that this would in any way endanger current sources and methods, I don't get it either, because obviously, due to electronic convention, the changes in communication, alliances, and everything else, I mean, one could argue that most of this would be irrelevant at this time. You know, we're not actively involved, as far as I know, in a campaign of sabotage and subterfuge against the island nation of Cuba. Okay, maybe in 1964 we still were. You know, and somebody could have said, look, he's connected to a whole bunch of stuff that is part of all sorts of covert operations here. And you could have made that argument then. But 60 years later, you know, this is the question. Like I said, even alliances have changed, right? There's no Cold War. We're not battling the communist world at this point, are we? You know, so what is the anyway, I'm throwing these things. Larry, you know I'm not asking you these questions. I'm just thinking out loud. And I think,
but
it's,
I think,
yeah,
Chuck, when people call and ask, why are we doing this? I think, will it end up being fruitless? Well, maybe, but the law is on our side and there is an element of principle. Mm-hmm. I mean, the element of principle involved is when Congress actually passes a law dealing with public information, it should be executed. I mean, if otherwise you really raise some questions about the political structure, then, you know, can a president just decide to go, oh, well, we're not going to pay any attention to that law. That's probably a bad thing, you know. So there are higher level principles involved in this. As far as Mary Farrell is concerned, you know, it's about history. And about reclaiming your own history and our foundation is concerned. So we're not doing it because we necessarily 100% believe that we'll accomplish all of our goals. But, you know, there's no reason not to.
Right. Well, and look, there are some people that would argue that, yes, the president is in a position to just sit there and ignore the legal precedents of any law or subpoena or whatever, right? There are people that make those arguments. I don't side with them. I don't think the president is above the law. I don't think the executive branch is above the law. And therefore, here we are. And also, you know, I stand by this idea, and maybe I'm crazy, Larry. I don't know. You could tell me I'm crazy. It's fine. But I have this idea that if these organizations, these agencies, these people creating these documents, tracking this stuff, participating in operations overt and covert, are allegedly working for, I don't know, we the people, you, me, everybody, seems as though ownership of these things is already ceded to us. So why we don't have access to things we own, there is another greater question, right? And at the very least, I mean, yeah, reclaim, I hate the fact that you use that phrase, but to reclaim history, yes, is a good thing. Not if you're Vince Bugliosi, but to reclaim history is a good thing. To actually claim it in the first place is nice, especially if it is the actual history. And you know, they tell us to, trust the authorities. Well, it's a little difficult when they don't wish to share the things that they created allegedly on our behalf. For our sake. For the sake of national security. I mean, after all, what is a nation without the people? And do the people not own these things? I ask again. I don't know. Maybe that's a crazy antiquated sort of idea about all of this. But at the end of the day, like you said, Mary Farrell Foundation is concerned with history, of course, filling in the gaps that have been constantly presented to us regarding not only this event, but many other events that are of significance, that are shrouded in some mystery, for certain, and have been examined and re-examined and again continue to be examined. And as I said, there has been an evolution about this where we have learned more over time because we've had to. And why? Because we were not directly informed. Perhaps if there was an effort to inform the American public, none of these questions would have ever emerged in the first place. Perhaps at the time, it was necessary to withhold certain things. I'm even willing to forgive that. You know, you just heard me do it, right? If we were still engaged, which we were, still engaged in covert warfare with this representative of the communist world, Cuba, right? Then maybe we didn't want to allow all that stuff to come out. Maybe it was time to keep things secret. But 6 decades later, yeah. I think the circumstances have changed. I'm pretty sure sources and methods have changed. I'm pretty sure almost anybody would have been employed back then. I mean, if they're 80 or 90 years old, okay. But I'm sure they're not actively engaged at this point in time in, you know, dangerous activities on the planet. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about that, and I'm being ageist here. But I'm just thinking that if somebody was 30 years old.
Yeah, I would agree, Chuck. You know, we know from past conversations, I am not a fan of real-time transparency in national security matters, intelligence matters, military matters. That's silly. You can't operate effectively. And I could even be sympathetic to the CIA officers that point that out. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, no, I can't call you on a stand and you tell me everything you're doing to protect me and let the other guys know everything you're doing. That's just silly. But right. Yeah, 30 years later, 40 years later, 50 years later, that's another thing. That operations are, when it's operational, fine. When things are all done and 30 years later, yeah, there should be transparency. So the time factor it's not just a matter of principle. There are two elements. It's principle and a reasonable amount of time to reveal the real history. I mean, if we did not know what we know now mm-hmm. about the missile crisis,
right.
We would, you know, we have a real understanding of what happened then. And that's because documents at the time were amazingly confidential. We can read them now. Mm-hmm. The same thing goes on for Vietnam. The same thing goes for, you know, they have disclosed rightly, according to classification guidelines, an immense amount of national security information so that we can do real history.
Exactly.
This is one of the areas where it almost stands out like, wait a minute, just last year, you've told me everything I want to know about all the military spy satellite programs from the 60s, 70s, and 80s into the 90s. You've given me all those documents. Now I know what you really did, what you really built, what you were able to see. You've given me that. Why won't you give me this guy's file out of Dallas who was the domestic contacts officer, Oswald? Come on. How does that make sense?
Exactly. Anyway, it doesn't, but I'll tell you what does make sense. Go to Larry-Hancock.com. Check out his blog. Obviously, I recommend, and as I say all the time, he occupies a lot more spots on my bookshelf than any other author, bar none. And there's a reason for it. Larry Hancock, I appreciate you taking the time to go over this with me, and geez, we ran right out of time. More to come on this, though, because by next week, we may have more to discuss. Anyway, I appreciate you. I appreciate Mike Swanson for being with me in the first hour. We talked about Elon Musk and social media mostly. Didn't expect that, but hey, you never know what's going to happen. And I do look forward to sitting down with Bill Simpich soon to find out the details on things as they emerge. Anyways, the Ocelli Effect is done, and no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, I hope you know I'm merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Good night.